We left off last class, we were talking about false messiahs, Shabtai Tzvi, and I want to just talk a little bit more about false messiahs and the reaction to them, because it bears a lot of relevance to the topic we're going to talk about today, which is primarily the issue of the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, the Hasidic movement, okay, which definitely is an outgrowth of this whole period of time. So we talk about Shabtai Tzvi, right? He got a significant percentage of the Jewish world into believing he's the Messiah. And I mentioned that, of course, eventually he converts to Islam, and he goes and he dies in exile in Turkey. And he has a following all the way up until this century, by the way. And what's more important is he fades away, but the impact of what he does, he especially and other false messiahs of the period, has a big counter-influence, meaning there's a big reaction to him in the Jewish world. There's a Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi of Amsterdam, who's known as the Chacham Tzvi, and his son, who's Rabbi Jacob Emden. If you study personalities of this period of time from the 17th century, he was one of the big opponents of mysticism and Shabtai Tzvi, and he has a big impact on how the Jewish community is going to react to this whole movement in the Jewish world. One of the people, by the way, who unfortunately falls victim to the counter-reaction of the religious world, meaning there's a big move against mysticism. Look where it led us to. False messianic expectation, false messiahs, people, thousands of Jews are going to believe in Judaism because of it. They get into all this alternative sort of movements which end up going off completely, like followers of Shabtai Tzvi. One of the people who falls victim is someone who we all know very well today, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the Ramchal, whose dates are 1707 to 1747, who actually comes to Israel and dies when he gets here. I say we know him well because he wrote a book which in its time, along with much of what he wrote, was very controversial. But in hindsight, we realize it's one of the great works of Musar. What's the book I'm talking about? Misilat Yesharim, The Path of the Just, which today everyone learns. But in his lifetime, he had a very rough time. He was a brilliant scholar, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. He seems to have mastered all of Torah. He was into mysticism. He was very into the idea of bringing the Messiah. He formed as a teenager a society to bring the Messiah through piety and constant study. He happens to be at a period of time which, following right after Shabtai Tzvi and the reaction of the Orthodox world, he comes under a lot of fire. He is hounded. You have a question? Because he's not because of what he says, as a matter of fact, but more because of the fact that there's a big reaction against mysticism, and he being a very mystical, profound thinker. Anyone who reads what he writes, you'll see very clearly. He's hounded out of Italy, okay, and eventually he comes to Israel and he dies at age 40. The Hasidim like to say that the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, is a reincarnation of the first 40 years of Rabbi Akiva's life. If you know the history of Rabbi Akiva, he was a complete ignoramus until age of 40. We have this idea in Judaism, a very Kabbalistic idea of transmigration of souls, that your soul gets recycled in the first 40 years of Rabbi Akiva's life when he wasn't learning Torah, so the Ramchal comes along. Okay, true, not true, who knows? But about you and I, they don't say such things. So it's an interesting idea. But if you read later, after, in the next generation, the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Elijah of Vilna, who's someone we'll be talking about a lot today because he's a very important person in the great schism of the Hasidim versus the Misnagdim of Lithuania. And the Vilna Gaon was an incredible genius. He basically said about the works of Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato that his understanding of Judaism was perfect. And that if he were alive in his generation, the Vilna Gaon living in the latter part of the 18th century, he would have walked from Vilna to Italy to sit at Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato's feet and learn. Okay, which is coming from, that's like Albert Einstein saying, if you're a physicist, you know, if he were alive my generation, I'd walk from, you know, Princeton to, you know, Podunk to learn physics from this guy. Okay, so it's obviously very high praise. But now, in hindsight, we realize after a lot of his books were burned, unfortunately, and he had to flee from Italy because he was considered too, you know, far out there. In hindsight, we appreciate that he was a tremendous genius. But this is part and parcel of what's going to be going on this whole period of time in the 18th century. So, and by the way, before we get into Hasidim and Misnagdim, there's a lot of great scholarship going on at this period of time. It's not just a period of time of schism. I just want to throw out a few names of people who, again, we don't have time to go into all of the personalities, but some of the great Torah personalities of this period of time. We have Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar, the Or Chaim, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, I just mentioned, the Ramchal, who died in 1747, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, the Pnei Yeshua, who died in 1756, Rabbi Aryeh Lev Gunzberg, the Shagas Aryeh, who died in 1758, Rabbi Yosef, Teomim, the Prima Godin, all these people you recognize not by their real names, but by, like, the Prima Godin, you'll hear the Shagas Aryeh, Rabbi Yeheskel Landau, the Noda B'Yehuda, all these people died in the mid-18th to late 18th century. So if you come across those names, these are Torah scholars from that period. What I want to focus on now, and for most of the rest of the time we have in this class, is Hasidut. Okay, today we're familiar with Hasidim. Hasidim begins, it's the product of a person by the name of Israel ben Eliezer, okay, who took on the name, we know him as the Baal Shem Tov. And his dates are 1700 to 1760. Rabbi Israel ben Eliezer was born in the Podolia province in Poland. According, he leaves no writings of his own. A lot of stories about him were collected by his followers and put together. So we don't have that much information about his life per se. But he was an orphan, raised as an orphan, poor child. He ends up marrying young and going off. His wife, I believe, name was Hannah. He goes off to the Carpathian Mountains where he works as a laborer. Okay, first he worked in a shul, as like a gabbai, a very interesting background. Nothing too impressive in terms of great accomplishments early on. But as he's working as a laborer, and he like schlepped, I think, sod or mud, he had like clay or something. He had some real back-breaking, heavy labor. He gets into the study of mysticism. Again, now keep in mind that if you look at the date, 1700 to 1760, which corresponds to, we're talking about the period of time of the Ramchal, mysticism is definitely not in. But he introduces this idea called Hasidut. Okay, and what is Hasidut? Focused on a number of things. Most people don't really understand what Hasidism is all about. People just think of singing and dancing. Definitely Hasidism is definitely involved in singing and dancing. To understand Hasidut, we have to appreciate what the situation is in the Jewish community in Europe in the 18th century. Remember, if we just think back in our minds what the Jewish community has gone through, we see it's a very bad period of time, right? We've gone through all of these expulsions and the impoverishment of the entire Jewish community, ghettoization, right? The massacres of Tachvatat in Khmelnytsky. Eastern European Jewish community especially is very poor, okay, living under a lot of hostility from the Eastern Orthodox Church and from the peasants of Eastern Europe. People are having to scratch out a meager living. They don't have time to really study the way they should. The level of scholarship is not where it's at. The morale of the people is quite low. So Hasidut, all the mystical stuff aside, its most basic, I would say, focus was to try to rejuvenate the soul of the Jews of Eastern Europe by reconnecting them. Very few Jews had the ability to sit and study in yeshiva. And there's a feeling also amongst some of the earlier followers of the Hasidic movement that Judaism had been over-intellectualized and it was too elite. Only a few people were studying it. The average Jew on the street was not connecting either intellectually or spiritually to God. Okay, so he brings in this whole movement which emphasizes the idea of bringing God into all aspects of your life, joyous prayer and singing. I think it's a mistake to say that Hasidut was like an attempt to like throw learning out and get into singing and dancing instead. I think that is a gross oversimplification. If people want to read, by the way, a very interesting article on it, there's a great book, which I have, here's the cover of it, Great Schisms in Jewish History. It's edited by Raphael Jospe, J-O-S-P-E, and Stanley M. Wagner. And in it is an article by, his name is Samuel Dresner. It's called Hasidim and its Opponents. It's a very good article if you want to read in depth. It's more or less from the Hasidic point of view about when a Hasidut is attacked, what is the reaction of Hasidut, defending what they believe in. It's a very deep topic we can't get into. I am not an expert on Hasidut. I am not myself a Hasid. I'm a Misnagdi. That's what Eshet Torah is. I'm not anti-Hasidut, but it's like Kabbalah is not a topic I feel qualified to go into a deep treatise on the different ideas. You're certainly welcome. There are plenty of people running around in the Jewish quarter, etc., who can explain it a lot better than I can because they are Hasidim. But one of the basic ideas of Hasidim was the idea of Dvekut. Okay, the idea of connecting to God, clinging to God, feeling God's presence in all aspects of existence. Okay, and a lot of that is, of course, associated with the idea of joy and prayer and not making it this kind of intellectual exercise. I want to read, by the way, a little article here. This is from Hasidim and its Opponents. Martin Buber, who is a great Jewish philosopher, he sums up very nicely. This is very intellectual sounding, but he sort of sums up the focus of what Hasidim is all about. Hasidut. He says, Judaism can be assumed, can be summed up in a single sentence. God can be beheld in each thing and reached through each pure deed. In the Hasidic teaching, the whole world is only a word out of the mouth of God. Nonetheless, the least thing in the world is worthy that through it God should reveal himself to man who truly seeks him. For no thing can exist without a divine spark, and each person can uncover and redeem this spark at each time and through each action. Even the most ordinary, if only he performs it in purity, wholly directed to God and concentrated in him. Therefore, it will not do to serve God only in isolated hours and with set words and gestures. One must serve God with one's whole life, with the whole of every day, with the whole of reality. The salvation of man does not lie in holding himself far removed from the worldly, but in consecrating it to holy, to divine meaning. His work and his food, his rest and his wanderings, the structure of his family and the structure of society. It lies in his preserving the great love of God for all creatures, yes, for all things. Hasidism took the social form of a great popular community, not an order of the secluded, not a brotherhood of the select, but a popular community in all its medley, in all its spiritual and social multiplicity. Never yet in Europe has such a community thus established the whole of life as a unity on the basis of the inwardly known. Here is no separation between faith and work, between truth and verification, or, in the language of today, between morality and politics. Here all is one kingdom, one spirit, one reality. It's very nice. Martin Buber, a very intelligent man, wrote very nicely. But it's this idea of trying to infuse your life with spirituality, all aspects. And when it comes out, it catches on very rapidly, especially in Eastern Europe, in Poland. Thousands and thousands of Jews are drawn into Hasidut. You know, we're talking about simple Jews, the Pintaliyid, as they call it, people who weren't big scholars, mostly living in very difficult situations. And it's not something that appears without opposition. Okay, a tremendous opposition is going to appear to the Hasidic movement. And the Hasidic movement, before I talk about the opposition, I just want to mention a couple of the differences. One of the major things, besides the notion of connecting to God through song and through prayer and through joy, which is something else to be a big Torah scholar to do, one of the very big differences between Hasidut, and certainly one of the things that was found to be problematic and still is in the mind of many people, is also the notion of a Rebbe. The Baal Shem Tov himself, the Besht, is considered the perfect example of sort of a spiritual holy man. When he returns from the Carpathian Mountains, he starts wandering around from community to community teaching. He soon gets a reputation as a very pious man, a mystical healer. He gets a huge following. And based on that model, we have this whole notion of the Rebbe. The Rebbe being, and this is an idea which is not in mainstream Judaism. It's a very revolutionary idea and, of course, very controversial. Of a person who sort of acts as an intermediary between the community and God. A person, because of his own spirituality and piety, elevates not only himself, but takes the whole community with him. That's what you have today in the Hasidic world. If you're familiar with different dynasties, and it is very much a dynastic sort of leadership position, you have different Rebbes, and if you go up into a Tish, you see the Rebbe, a Tish Zecha, on Friday night they'll do, where I live, the Carlin Rebbe, Carlin Stolen. The Rebbe lives in my community. I go to the Tish on Friday night after everyone eats. They come down with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe eats a piece of challah, and they pass it all around because the Rebbe blessed it. It's on a higher spiritual level. For those us misnagdim, it's a bit hard to relate to personally. I don't relate to it, but I can see why it's controversial. The notion of intermediaries in Judaism is not really. Judaism is you take responsibility direct to God. Okay, that's so it's not such an easy idea to accept. Yeah.
And then you don't pray to the dead. You can pray through a great study I read in a book that those who have died and gone before, it's something you can pray to God and say, it's not on my merit, on their merit, it's something you can.
Okay, I don't want to get it. Praying, going to Kvarot, to graves and praying is a very problematic thing in Judaism, you should know. It's very problematic. The main reason you're supposed to go to a funeral, a cemetery, is to get fear. You know, you're going to die and you're going to stand before God in judgment. And people used to do that on Erev Yom Kippur. The notion of taking these tours to different places like Tzfat and the Amuka, whatever. Okay, I don't want to get into it now. I don't like it personally. I think it's very problematic halachically. I'm just giving my personal opinion now. I find the whole notion of someone sort of being Yotzi connecting to God for you is somewhat of a cop-out. That's my personal view on it. I'm not attacking Hasidic movement at all here. I'm just saying, I understand why people see it as problematic. I don't want to go into who's right, who's wrong, whatever. Suffice to say, there are lots of Hasidic dynasties today, and the notion of a holy man is a very big thing, the tzaddik, the rebbe. Some people take it to bigger extremes than the others, obviously, without mentioning names. And out of that is formed a whole bunch of different Hasidic dynasties. And there's a lot of personalities. We have, not to go into all the different names of people, but the Hasidic communities have basically, even though they moved around the world, just like the yeshivas in Babylon, they moved, but they took the names with them. Okay, so we have, if you look in Jerusalem today, you go to the Bible Belt, northern Jerusalem, you'll see there's Sanz and Bells and Satmar and Karlin Stolen. These are all names of communities, mostly in places like Poland and Romania. Okay, they moved, they took the names with them. And they keep the names, and they make little communities, Kiryat Sanz, Kiryat Bells. And they preserve everything, not just the name of the place, but the traditions and the dress. And, you know, people walking around today wearing Hasidic garb is basically the garb worn by, you know, Jews in the 18th century. To a large extent. A very actually interesting side point is some of the names of the places. Maybe some of you heard me say this. Satmar. You ever heard of Satmar? One of the more extreme, I mean extreme, in terms of being very anti the state of Israel, whatever. Satmar Hasidim, Satmar is the town of St. Mary's in Romania. Okay? The St. Mary's Hasidim. It's very funny. Ger is the town of Gur Calvaria in Poland. Calvary Hill is in Jerusalem where Jesus was crucified. So you have the Calvary Hill Hasidim, the St. Mary's Hasidim, you know. It's pretty funny. The reason why I don't have any Hasidim from Michigan is through the Michigan Hasidim, so I guess they don't have that. But you have New Square in New York, you have the Square Rebbe, the Boston Rebbe, you know, it's very interesting. So this is where the dynasties come from. So suffice to say, it is a movement on the positive side that has had a huge impact in spiritually revitalizing the Jewish world. No question about it. Okay. It brought a lot, it kept a lot of people in Judaism, put a lot of joy back into Judaism. It did not end up ruining Judaism as was feared. But unfortunately, I think due to A, the fact that it appears at a time after in this big backlash against mysticism and messianic expectation, and a lot of Hasidut is involved in mystical study, as the Baal Shem Tov was involved in, and Kabbalah is a much bigger thing in the Hasidic world. So it basically came under the fire of the more, you know, traditional, I would say, intellectual Jewish community, especially Lithuania, which was where the real gedolim of the Jewish world, the great scholars, people like the Vilna Gaon, were living. And as a matter of fact, I want to, by the way, run through names of these people who have studied the history of Hasidut, just throwing out names, you can look them up on your own. The Maggid of Mezrich, who was 1698 to 1772, Rav Shneur Zalman of Lida, who was the Chabad, who was the Balatanya, the original, if you read the Tanya, he's the 1745 to 1813. The Chose of Lublin, 1745 to 1815. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, 1772 to 1811, an interesting sect of Hasidim, because when he died, they never replaced him. And today, Breslover, we're definitely far out there in terms of Hasidim. You've never seen them singing and dancing by the Kotel and everything, especially, you know. Nachman Uman, that's Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, exactly. Rabbi Nachman Mendel of Kotz, the Kotzker Rebbe, 1787 to 1859. Many of these people are very significant personalities in the Jewish community of Europe in the 18th century. And there's a lot more people. There's all kinds of, you can go get art scrolls, they have all kinds of biographies of these different people, read about their lives and the things they did. It's a very interesting period of time in Jewish history. I mean, some of these people are very fascinating personalities. Yeah. Well, I don't know. The rabbis accept the position. It sort of comes with the job description. It also evolves as an idea. So it's not a question, I become rabbi if I sign the contract. I will be an intern for a community. It's expected that if you're a rabbi, you have a higher position of holiness. Just as, you know, a big Torah scholar is expected in the Jewish world today where the majority of Jews are not great scholars, he's expected to interpret the law and apply it because he's considered a higher authority in terms of halacha. So to a rabbi, he's considered a higher authority in terms of spirituality. I don't know if I would generalize it. Every single rabbi had X attitude. How different people related to the responsibility of being rabbi, I honestly don't know.
But
Charles Barkley once said, "No, I am not a role model." And people expected that, you know, people his fans expected that he was Charles Barkley. Well, the difference between Charles Barkley, Lahavdil, and the Hasidic Rebbe is that Charles Barkley, his great accomplishment in the area of basketball. Any religious Jew is supposed to be a role model to everyone, you know. So it's an all-encompassing way of life that includes a whole moral, ethical component which is not in basketball. It's a sad statement, not to attack modern society, but it's a sad statement that the great heroes of the world today are all either actors, musicians, or sports people. And if you look at the personal lives of most of these people, in my opinion, they're usually not good examples. It is the rare person in entertainment. Like, I personally have a lot of respect for Oprah Winfrey. I find that the one or two times I've actually seen her show, that she's actually teaching a message of morality, whatever, but I don't get into personalities now. But it's a big difference. I would say that is expected in the Jewish world traditionally. If you're in a position of leadership, whether it's halachically or as a Rebbe, you are expected to be a role model. Because as a Jew, you're expected to be a role model. So there's huge differences. I don't think you could begin to compare them. But anyway, I want to look a little bit at the counter-reaction, because in the Lithuanian community especially, Hasidut was attacked very strongly. Now, it was attacked for some reasons which one could call legitimate, and attacked for many reasons which are probably not legitimate, meaning that it came in the wake of all of this mysticism and false messianic expectation. And because of that, it comes under fire. By the way, before just, I want to mention one other person who you might, a side point, another false messiah whose name might come up, who is relevant to this period of time. You should know false messianism was alive and well in the 18th century, not just during Shabbos feast time. Man by the name of Jacob Frank. You ever heard of Frankists? There's many false messiahs. He's another one after Shabbos feast. Nowhere near as big, but also very destructive. He lived from 1726 to 1791. He was a guy who really went off. Matter of fact, it was rumored about him. He used to like have orgies and seduce married women. He did all kinds of funky stuff. He is eventually going to basically be excommunicated in the Jewish community. He is going to, in Poland, he's from also from Podolia, where the Baal Shem Tov is from. He is going to, I think the Bishop of Lvov, instigate against the Jewish community. He's basically going to break away completely and attack the Jewish community, attack the Talmud. There's going to be a debate in 1757, there's a debate between the Frankists and the Talmudists, and of course the Talmudists lose. Frank sort of tries to show that he is supporting of Jesus. He's a very weird guy. And he goes off. He's eventually himself exiled for claiming he's the Messiah. But he's a classic example of a guy who really loses it. I mean, gets into all kinds of kinky things, completely off. But when he dies afterwards, a lot of his followers return to Judaism. His daughter, I think, follows in his footsteps and also is a pretty wacko. Yeah, she takes over the so-called dynasty, but they all disappeared. They're not around anymore. But you should know that there are other people running around at this period of time who are only feeding the flames of suspicion about anything mystical and messianic. The major personality to focus on at this period of time is the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Elijah of Vilna, who lives from 1720 to 1797. He is, again, right around, for those of us thinking of American history, he's right around the time of the American Revolution. He's living in Vilna. A person of absolutely tremendous intellect. A guy who at age 6 started to teach halacha.
What?
Age 6, he gave a whole halacha shiur. This is unbelievable, this guy. He was a man who is not only the master, he's author of over 70 works on various things, commentaries, you name it. Tremendous intellect. By the way, he's also very Kabbalistically inclined, the villain. He wasn't like one of these pure, he was into mysticism, but he kept it, you know, on the side. But just tremendous intellect. He got the title, his name is Rabbi Elijah ben Shlomo Zalman, but we call him the Vilna Gaon. Gaon here meaning not like the Gaonim in Babylon, but Gaon meaning great one, tremendous intellect. Probably in the history of great Jewish thinkers, he, in terms of raw IQ, he's probably way, way off the scale. And he was a tremendous secular scholar, too. Tremendous, his knowledge of mathematics, of astronomy, physics of the day, anatomy. He was like the real Renaissance guy, a guy you don't see people like this, unfortunately, anymore. And he did all kinds of commentaries on the oral law, on the written law, and the Gaon is just one of the great characters. People always coming out with stuff. He's a person who shunned honor. Tremendous. Matter of fact, his son said he basically never slept. He'd sleep four times a day, according to his son, for an hour. He catnapped four times a day for 1 hour. And to keep himself awake, he would study standing up in an unheated room with his feet in a bucket of cold water. This is a guy who was like unbelievable, like study, study, study. He would never take any position. I don't suggest trying that. You might fall in the bucket and drown. But he never took an official position. He took a small stipend his whole life. Very, very, very modest. As in most great Jewish personalities, very humble. Okay, only someone who, he was someone in his lifetime had tremendous respect, was recognized by everyone as being an incredible genius. He actually tried to come to Israel towards the end of his life. He never made the turn back, and he never really explained why. He said it just wasn't in the cards. It wasn't meant to be. His students, however, will come back to Israel. When we talk about the reestablishment of the Jewish community in Israel, some of the earliest, the real beginnings of the Ashkenazi community in Jerusalem are going to be the followers of the Vilna Gaon. He has one student who's a very important personality we're going to look at in a couple of classes, Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, who is going to be the founder of the modern yeshiva movement. I don't want to say more about him now, but the impact of the Vilna Gaon is tremendous. He also leads the movement against the Hasidim. Okay? As a matter of fact, the Hasidim will send a delegation to him, I think it's twice, to try and talk to him. He doesn't want to even speak to them. He felt the Hasidut is a very dangerous movement. Okay, his certainly part of that was the general reaction of the Jewish rabbinic community of Lithuania against, again, as I said before, mysticism and the messianism. People were afraid that they would get into that Hasidus was another false messianic thing. The Baal Shem Tov, people start following, he's the Messiah. Okay, and part of it was just that the movement came at the wrong time, and part of it was this Hasidism was, as we see, we get later in Jewish history, the Orthodox world is going to become more and more reactionary. Because of external attacks and all the persecutions that they've gone through, and not only that, the real factor that I think is going to make the Orthodox world very reactionary is what goes on within the Jewish community. Splinter movements, we're going to see reform, conservative, the Enlightenment, assimilation, false messianism. It's really going to be like taking all these body punches and getting very, very defensive. And this is really the beginning of, we're going to see a real inwardly focused movement in the religious world. Yeah. Forgetting a term, yes, I say Orthodox people who keep Torah. There is really no secular Jewish world at the time yet. That's a topic for a class coming up very soon. We get to assimilation. The secular Jewish world is really not going to be a main big thing until the 19th century. So the Torah world, yeah, but you know, I'm talking about specifically the leadership of the Torah world. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, posthumously, he said.
Isn't that contradictory? Because there was another guy. I mean, his writings were also based on mysticism, weren't they?
The Vilna Gaon has nothing against mysticism. He was a person who knew Kabbalah and mysticism tremendously. It wasn't that the information. It was the feared impact of such people that they would be considering themselves false messiahs. People would follow them. They would lead the people down a dangerous path. When the Vilna Gaon of a tremendous intellect looked at the works of the Ramchal and realized what tremendous genius they were, he gave them credit where credit was due. So it wasn't that. The Baal Shem Tov didn't write anything. No, the Baal Shem Tov is not. No, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. We have writings about the Baal Shem Tov in stories, but he didn't write anything. He wasn't this big, you know. The Ramchal was tremendously prolific. There's lots of his works that have never been published. I've seen handwritten copies of books of his that I've never seen in print, you know, copied by people. At different periods of time, whatever. And a lot of his works are destroyed. We don't have them anymore. But the Vilna Gaon is going to lead the movement against Hasidut, which is called the Mitnagdim, the Misnagdim, which means to be against. And eventually, in 1772, they are going to excommunicate the Hasidim. And the Hasidim are going to send people to try and talk to the Vilna Gaon, and he is not going to even speak to them. He was very strongly against. And it's obvious that a guy like the Vilna Gaon, who's a tremendous genius, he had what to be afraid of. He's not just being paranoid here. There's obviously things in Hasidut which were potentially dangerous to the future of the Jewish community. And he felt that we have to stop it. Now, in the end, of course, we see that all's well that ends well. There was no big schism. We don't have two separate religious worlds. More or less, the two communities are still Hasidic communities, but there's an ultra-Orthodox world, which is by no means monolithic, but which is unified in that we keep the same Torah, we have different customs, but it didn't cause a tremendous split and big, big problems. The big fear, I think, of when you read what these people say, and I'm going to read you a letter, the rabbinic leaders of Vilna, April 1772, their big fear was the de-intellectualization of Torah, singing and dancing is not what Judaism is about. It's about study. It's about synthesizing, you know, the heart and the mind together in a logical way. The Vilna Gaon, I would say the best way to summarize his view of the world is that the true religion was demonstrated by harmony between the heart and the mind, and not too much heart there. Too much singing and dancing is dangerous. And I want to read, this is from The Jews in the Modern World, that book that's in your bibliography, the best book in terms of primary sources on everything related to modern Jewish history. This is excommunication of the Hasidim. Our brethren, sons of Israel, says this manifesto, as you know, new people have appeared, unimagined by our forefathers, who have formed a sect of Hashudim. They're making a play on words. Hashud means to be suspect. Instead of saying Hasidim. Okay? And they associate amongst themselves, and their ways are different from other children of Israel in their liturgy. I mean, they're changing the prayers. Okay? And in their recitation of the 18 benedictions, they roar in abominable words and in the vernacular Yiddish. Okay? And they behave in crazed manners and say that their thoughts wander in all worlds. And they belittle the study of Torah and repeatedly claim that one should not study much, but nor deeply regret one's transgressions. Every day is a festival for them, and while standing during their false prayers, voice sounds that are different, and there is a loud commotion in the town, and they behave like the vision of the wheels, upside down and bottoms up. The note meaning some of them would actually stand on their heads to pray. And people doing very funky things then. This is just the tip of the iceberg, one of their thousand despicable ways, as the above Hashudim have admitted to us, and praise God that their crime was revealed by heaven amongst us, that they themselves confessed following a thorough investigation. Therefore we have come to inform our brethren, children of Israel, from near and far, all leaders of our people must wear the mantle of zealotry for the Lord of hosts, to destroy and expunge, and to sound to them the voice of excommunication and banishment. And with God's help, we have already uprooted their evil belief from among us. And just as we have uprooted it here, may it be uprooted everywhere, and through they entreat you not to believe them. For the seven abominations are in their hearts. Until they themselves repent completely, they must be divided and dispersed such that two heretics should not be found together, because two of the same breed are prohibited from everything, and it befits the world to separate them. It's heavy stuff. Look at the language. It's unbelievable. It sounds like Satan worshippers, you know? But you have to understand, they were doing some funky things, the early Hasidim, a lot of singing and dancing, and it was very, very, you know, controversial and different at the time. Okay, I'm not going to debate who's right and who's wrong. In the end, we see that I believe the descendants of the Baal Shem Tov ended up marrying the descendants of the Vilna Gaon. As I see today, the Hasidim, they study Talmud, they have yeshivas, the Misnagdim have gotten a little more spiritual, even have davening Reb Shlomo minions now, you know, so... The Jewish world is definitely more colorful and diverse because of this. And in hindsight, we see it did certainly revitalize to a large extent the Eastern European community, which was in a very bad way spiritually, and brought a lot of people back to Judaism who could well have been lost because they did not have the time to study the way they should. And probably the pressure brought by the Misnagdim against the Hasidim acted as a break from keeping them going too far. Without that, who knows? They could have gone off and created another religion, and we would have had something funky going on that wasn't Judaism anymore. Don't know. Can't. What ifs in history you can't speculate on. Okay, so that's the Hasidim and Misnagdim. You can look at those sources for more information. Before we go further, I want to just jump out of Jewish history for a minute and talk for the last few minutes about the Protestant Reformation, okay? Because it's very important to the Jewish communities of Europe, Protestant Reformation. Yeah, remember, Jewish history does not happen in a vacuum, and we have to always keep in mind, we're going back in time now, we have to always keep in mind that the external things going on in the secular world, or the Western world, or the Gentile world, always have big impact on the Jews. You know, we talked about the Catholic Church earlier, about how after the decline of the Roman Empire, it becomes the great feudal player in the economic social system of Europe, the church being an all-powerful entity, you know, Innocent III in the 12th century, owning more land in France and Germany than nobility owned, okay? The church is going to become more and more powerful politically, even militarily. By the Renaissance, the church is a very powerful entity, okay? In terms of, still today, I say it's the world's largest multinational, over a billion stockholders. It owns more land in Manhattan than any other institution. Columbia University is number two, by the way. But we're talking about a very powerful institution, and an institution which by no means practiced what it preached. The most dangerous book to the Catholic Church was the Bible. Okay, I kid you not that it was actually, in countries in Europe, the Bible was only in Latin, which couldn't be understood by the common person anyway, and could not be read publicly, because God forbid, Catholic... simple people should start hearing what the Bible says. They'll realize that the most hypocritical institution on the planet Earth is the church itself, which does not practice what it preaches, is totally into materialism and into decadence, okay? Contains the only, besides the Jewish community, literate people who, of course, their major occupation was copying texts and then not letting anyone have access to them. So we're talking about a very closed society, one that practiced censorship and inquisition and became incredibly decadent and materialistic in and of itself. And just as power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, the church itself becomes incredibly materialistic and decadent. And if you read, I can't begin to go into the topic, which is a fascinating one, but you see how hypocritical the church becomes. By the 14th century, by the way, the papacy was basically an institution that was bought. And it splits. In the 14th century, you have two popes. You have a pope in Avignon in France and a pope in Rome. That's how bad it got. As a matter of fact, if you read Boccaccio, one of the early 14th century, I believe, one of the earliest writers of Italian fiction, he wrote a book called The Cameron, which is a fascinating. You want to read early literature, you got to read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. These are all about the same period of time. Boccaccio, this is all Renaissance, early Renaissance literature, first fiction you see. In the Cameron, Boccaccio writes this very interesting. It's a story about a bunch of Italian nobility who flee from, I believe it is Rome during the plague, and are hanging out in a villa to avoid getting the plague and dying. And to entertain themselves before they have cable TV, they tell stories. And one of the stories is the story of an Italian who has a friend by the name of, I'm not sure he's Italian, I might be a Frenchman, who has a friend by the name of Abraham, who's always trying to convince a Jew, who's trying to convince him to become a Catholic. And he's always hocking his cup, as we say in Yiddish, to convince him to go. And Abraham is always saying, no. Finally, Abraham says, okay, I'll go to Rome, I'll see the Pope, just so you stop yelling at me. And he goes off to Rome, and then the Catholic starts freaking out, because he realizes that the Pope at the time is literally having orgies in the Vatican. The Vatican wasn't built quite then. But in Rome, I kid you not, you had popes who had armies and walked around like kings and had mistresses and illegitimate children. And, you know, these bastard, you know, the Medicis, you read the lives of these people. Again, it makes the royal families of Rome in the first and second centuries seem like big tzaddikim. Okay. And the Catholic starts freaking out that, oh my God, he's going to come back. He's going to see what's going on. He's never going to convert. Abraham comes back and gives this whole speech. I don't have it in front of me, but it's great. He basically says that I go to Rome. I've never seen people who are so decadent and disgusting and immoral and who are trying to drive goodness out of the world. Then he says, nonetheless, your religion keeps growing and prospering, so nothing in the world will keep me from becoming a Catholic. And he converts. It's not a happy ending for the Jews, but it just shows you. It's amazing, the 14th century, that the people are aware of how decadent the church is. Especially by the 16th century, when the Catholic Church is trying to build the Vatican, they have to suck in huge sums of money, just like in the 17th century. Louis XIV bankrupts France to build Versailles, this city-sized palace. If you've been to France, you can see it. So, too, the Catholic Church needs vast amounts of money. They start selling indulgences, which are these letters that if you buy this letter, the soul of your mother, father, aunt, uncle, whatever, will get out of hell and go to paradise. As a matter of fact, a Dominican monk by the name of Tetzel used to go around Europe fundraising and he had a little ditty. It was like, as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. Buy indulgences, and, you know, that little riddle, the little rhyme he had. So a lot of people in the lower church officials, especially, were getting disgusted, monks, with the decadence of the church and feeling it had betrayed all the basic tenets of Christianity. Protestantism is a product of many people. There were many attempts in the 14th, 15th century to translate the Bible into the local language and secretly distribute it. And by the way, 1453, printing press appears in Europe. You see, right, books are now able to be printed cheaply in large numbers. With that begins the illegal movement to translate the Bible into local languages that people can read. So the rate of literacy is going to rise, the availability of the Bible is going to rise. People like Wycliffe, the Lollards, I don't want to go into the history of Protestantism, many people are caught and killed for translating and distributing the Bible illegally. Okay, we also have at this period of time, not too soon after, in 1534, I believe, 1534, right, Henry VIII, because he dumps Catherine of Aragon to marry one of her chambermaids, Anne Boleyn. The church won't give him a divorce or annul his marriage. So he decides, well, I'll make my own church, and he forms the Church of England. So already have rebellion is in the air. Okay, so a lot of people are realizing that this can't go on. The church tries to reform itself too little, too late. The main person I want to talk about is Martin Luther. Martin Luther, who was an Augustinian friar, disgusted with the decadence of the church in 1517, puts a letter on the door of the castle church in Wittenberg with a 94 theses, protesting, which is the word Protestant comes from, protest, protestia, against the decadence of the church. The church demands that he recant. He does not. He splits from the church and forms his own religion, an offshoot of mainstream Latin Christianity called Protestantism, which gets a lot of backing very soon by the nobility, especially of Northern Europe, who are more than happy to throw the Catholic Church out of their land so they can get all the money. So there's a lot of economics involved in the success of Protestantism. So it's a genuine movement of reform combined with the economic realities and discussed with the church, which is going to totally change Europe. It's going to be the main reason for the big war. We mentioned the 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648, which is going to devastate Europe. It's going to cause a lot of friction between Protestants and Catholics, and a lot of bloodshed and loss of life and destruction. And it's going to have a big impact on the Jews. Martin Luther, who is not, again, the only person in Protestantism, but the one we know of the most, he felt that the Catholic, you know why Jews didn't convert to Christianity? Because Catholics are such hypocrites that any Jew looking at them would never want to become a Catholic. I want to read you, this is from What Did They Think of the Jews, a great book about what all these people in history thought of Jews. Look what Martin Luther says about the Jews. He says, "For they, the Catholic clergy, have dealt with Jews as if they were dogs and not human beings. They have done nothing for them but curse them and seize their wealth. I hope that if Jews are treated friendly and are instructed kindly enough through the Bible, many of them will become real Christians and come back to the ancestral faith of the prophets and patriarchs. I would advise and beg everyone to deal kindly with the Jews. We must receive them kindly and allow them to compete with us in earning a livelihood, so that they may have a good reason to be with us and among us and have an opportunity to witness Christian life and doctrine. And if some remain obstinate, what of it? Not every one of us is a good Christian." What's the idea? If we are nice and not hypocritical, and the Jews see how real Christians will behave, they'll come back. This is like a revolution. This is wonderful. We're going to have nice Christians. This is taking place, you know, who are going to not hate us. And now, unfortunately, the Jews don't go for Protestantism. I say fortunately for us, but unfortunately for Martin Luther, Jews are not into Protestantism at all. They look at it the same way as Catholicism. It's a lie. We don't go for it. Martin Luther is going to change his tune and go from being a guy who's initially friendly to one of the most virulent anti-Semites in the last 500 years. And I want to read what he says a few years later. Look at the contrast. "What shall we do with this damned, rejected race of Jews? Since they live among us, and we know about their lying and blasphemy and cursing. We cannot tolerate them, even if we do not wish to share their lies, curses, and blasphemy. Perhaps we can spare a few of them from the fire and flames. Let me give you my honest advice." This is like Pirkei Avot for the Protestants. "First, their synagogues, their churches should be set on fire. Secondly, their homes should be likewise be broken down and destroyed. Thirdly, they should be deprived of their prayers, books, and Talmuds. Fourth, their rabbis must be forbidden under threat of death to teach anymore. Fifthly, passports and traveling privileges should be absolutely forbidden to Jews. Sixthly, they ought to be stopped from usury. All their cash and valuables of silver and gold ought to be taken from them. If, however, we are afraid that they might harm us personally, let us drive them out of the country for all time." That's what you call a big about face. And you want to see where the Germans are going to pick up on their anti-Semitism, because Germany, Northern Europe, becomes overwhelmingly Protestant. They're going to have lots of Martin Luther sayings to borrow from. So we see that this is going to set the stage for what is going to be, you know, when we get to the Holocaust, we're going to see it has its basis in traditional Catholic thought about Jews and all the ridiculous accusations that come out against Jews with more modern Protestant anti-Semitic thought. Now, definitely the Protestant Reformation on the good side is going to break the monopoly of the Catholic Church. It comes, as all things in hindsight, at a period of time when Europe is going through very rapid changes. This is the border between the end of the Renaissance and the beginning of the Enlightenment, which is the period of time I want to talk about tomorrow. And now that the Church is sort of shunted aside, we're going to have a huge pouring in of not just new Christian thought, but sort of secular way, the classical way of looking at the world that the Renaissance is going to start is going to become much more powerful during this period of time called the Enlightenment. And we're going to have the real emergence of much stronger nation states, okay, and strong monarchies. And all of this is going to, of course, have a huge impact on European history and also be very, very impactful on what's going to happen to the Jews. So we'll stop here. Tomorrow we're going to do the Enlightenment. And we're going to talk a little about German anti-Semitism. And